Good evening, welcome to What Would Jesus Say to Stephen Hawking. Please do feel free to queue at the bar and to order a drink. We're going to start anyway, just to make sure that we give plenty of time to hear what Jesus might say to Stephen Hawking, and also give you guys plenty of time to ask questions and to discuss it afterwards. So we're going to make a start now. It's great to see so many of you here. I hope you'll be able to see the screen. Much of what we're going to look at this evening will also, you'll be helped to be able to see that screen. My name is Neil Powell. I'm one of the pastors at City Church. It's great to have you here, whether you're a regular at these events or this is the first time. Thank you very much for coming. And it's a special honour to be able to invite Professor Andy Schofield from Birmingham University. He's going to be speaking to us this evening on what Jesus might say to Stephen Hawking. Just to explain the format of the evening, if you've not been to these evenings before, Andy's going to speak for about 25 minutes, and then we're going to have a short break. You'll be able to visit the bar again or use the facilities, and then after that it'll be over to you in a kind of a question and answer format. So there are two ways in which you can ask questions or make comments. One is a roving mic that will get go around the place, and you can just stick a hand up and that'll come to you. That's the best way, that's the way we prefer, because it just means we can interact more directly. But if you're the kind of person who just like to write something down or write a question on a piece of paper, that's fine too. And so during the break between the talk and the question and answer, either write something down then or write it down as we go along in the talk, and then we'll collect those up and we'll read those out and try and respond to those as well. So we've got about 25 minutes for a talk, short break, 25 minutes for question and answer, and then pizzas will be arriving, and you're welcome to stay around, talk about things over pizza and a drink until about 9:30. So that's really our format this evening, and I'm going to hand straight over to Andy. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Neil. The one thing Neil didn't say is that I'm a visitor, so like you, for some of you, this format is new to me too. So my name is Andy Schofield, and for my job, I'm a professor of theoretical physics at the University of Birmingham. I was trying to look out if I could see some of my students, but I haven't as yet. Maybe they've heard me before. I'm married to Sally, and I've got three children, Jack, who's 11, Kessia, who's 8, and Tom, who's 4. And I guess I first probably took seriously the claims of Jesus Christ when I was about 7 years old, but I should say that since that time it's been a bit of a voyage of discovery, and somehow it has led me to this point here where I have to tell you what Jesus would say to Stephen Hawking. So I'm going to do that in three parts. I'm going to tell you a little bit about Stephen himself and why he's well known as a scientist and beyond. I'm going to tell you a little bit about some of the things he said, and then I'm going to attempt finally to put an answer to the question that was posed by Neil to me in the title. So let's begin with Stephen himself. Who is he? Well, he's probably the most recognised scientist living today on the planet. He is a theoretical physicist, and that's what I do too. I work on the quantum properties of matter. He tends to work on gravity and quantum mechanics. You don't need to understand what that is. His job, he's paid for by the University of Cambridge. He holds the Lucasian Professorship of Mathematical Physics at Cambridge. And it's a very distinguished position to have. And in fact, you know, one of his predecessors Sir Isaac Newton. And, of course, Newton was the person who was the first one to kind of write down the rules of gravity. And gravity has really been a theme of Stephen's research. So perhaps to kind of put his life in a bit of context, can I tell you some of the things that he's known for in the scientific community? The first of which actually builds on a later theory of gravity that Einstein developed. Now, one of the things that Einstein's theory predicted is that if you get a star that's big enough, when it runs out of fuel, there's nothing to hold it up, and gravity pulls it down. And a first reading of Einstein's equations kind of predicted that all matter should collapse down into a point, a single point, which we tend to call a singularity, where the laws of physics, indeed the theory that predicted that it should be there in the first place, would break down. And people felt very uncomfortable with that, And in fact, there was a suggestion that what might happen is that as the matter from the star collapsed, it would kind of miss the middle singularity and just go through it, and you'd get round it that way. And when Stephen Hawking was a graduate student, he essentially showed that that was not a good escape route, and that, if you like, if you paraphrase it, that our theory of gravity necessarily involves a crunch, a singularity. And of course, what that means is that there's no way out, if the theory of gravity is correct, that you should have things called black holes, things that even light can't escape from. And the other consequence of his discovery is that as you run Einstein's equations backwards in time, it tells us that the universe itself will have started from this singularity-like thing. Okay, so that's what he did when he was actually quite a young person. The next thing, probably the thing he's most famous for, is for, again, a bit of work on black holes, where what he discovered was that black holes aren't black. Now, that's a little bit harder to explain, and I'm not going to go into great details, and you won't need to know it for this. But for those of you that are interested, what he did is he kind of combined Einstein's theory of what gravity was like with the theory of subatomic particles. And something very bizarre that we find when we look at subatomic particles is they appear and disappear. Even when you've got what you think is empty space, it's actually teeming with particles appearing in pairs and disappearing again. And what Hawking said was that, well, actually, if you're very close to a black hole, not quite so close that everything has to fall into it, one of these pairs appearing, well, one of them could fall into the black hole and be lost forever, but the other one could escape and never have the chance to find its partner again. Well, actually, when I said that to Sally, she went, oh, that's so sad. not really how we think about things, but anyway. The result is that this particle flies out, and so what Hawking managed to show was that, in fact, there would be this stream of particles coming out from the surface of a black hole, which actually, in the end, will evaporate the black hole completely. So that's Hawking radiation. He did that in the 70s. The final thing is, unlike the first two, is a little bit more speculative, not fully established yet by the scientific community. That previous one, by the way, was not believed at first, and then suddenly people realised that not only was Hawking right, but he had to be right to be consistent with the other laws of physics that we knew. This is a little bit more speculative, called the no boundary condition of the universe, and it's back to those singularities again. And one of the holy grails in physics, as we'll see, is to try and unify Einstein's theory of gravity with this theory of subatomic particles. And Hawking has made a speculation as to what that theory must look like. And to kind of paraphrase it, if you like, he's argued that if you try to ask the question, well, what is it like before the Big Bang, it's a little bit like asking the question, what it lies north of the North Pole. His analogy is that the start of the universe is a no more special point than the North Pole is on the surface of the Earth. So those are three of the things that Hawking has done. And you might ask, well, are those so groundbreaking that this guy is the top scientist living on the planet? Well, I think probably it's fair to say that they are very impressive discoveries, but they don't by themselves turn him into the living incarnation of Albert Einstein. He's not quite in that league. But of course, what has really pushed him to the forefront of public opinion is not so much his science necessarily, but his other personal achievements. And of course, the one thing that I'm sure many of you know about him is that at the age of 21, he was diagnosed with a type of motor neuron disease. I'm not a medic, so I don't know the details, but as I understand it, it's a disease which has no cure, it's degenerative, and was expected to take his life in a matter of a few years. As it happens, it has indeed taken away his mobility. He's almost completely paralyzed, speaks through a voice synthesizer, but has not in any way interrupted his scientific productivity, as far as we can tell. And indeed, he's far outlived that original prognosis. And my understanding is that he is the longest living survivor so far of this present illness. And I think his personal triumph over extremely difficult personal circumstances rightly really turns him into a rather special kind of person. Of course, the other thing that many people know about him is he's written a book, at least he's written a number of books, in fact. I'm told it's one of the few bestsellers that has never been read. And this is not his only book, A Brief History of Time, but he has a great way of turning what is abstract science into something that is tangible that people can start to try and get their heads around. And of course, probably the highlight, probably the highlight that he would say of his career so far is appearing on The Simpsons. Now, I guess you might have thought that as a theoretical physicist myself, I probably at least would have read this book. But let me make a confession early on that I have not read the book. I like to think for reasonably good reasons, which is because when I was an undergraduate student in Cambridge, we got to hear that there were some rather special lectures going on that weren't advertised anywhere, but that it might be interesting to go along to them. So I went and found a room absolutely packed out. And of course, what it was Stephen was giving some lectures, and these were the lectures that a few months later were to become the book. And it was a really extraordinary experience to be a part of that, because, well, a very minor part of that, I hasten to add. It was packed out. You had to get there half an hour early if you wanted to have anything like a seat. And as his wheelchair would come onto the stage, it would go deadly silent. And then in his characteristic voice, he would say, "Can you hear me at the back?" And I can still hear that voice ringing out. It was a wonderful set of lectures. It later became the book, but that wasn't the end of my interactions with him. In fact, later on, I was a fellow at the same college as he was. And if you look very carefully, I am in this picture, but since it probably isn't that obvious, it's in there. And if you zoom in, you'll see that one of these people is a famous theoretical physicist. So that takes me on to the second. What would Jesus say to Stephen Hawking? Well, I need to know what kind of thing Stephen believes. And I don't really have much more personal insight to him. I mean, I did talk to him, but like many scientists, it wasn't the first thing one talked about, what you believe. We'd talk about what you were doing scientifically. I guess maybe one additional bit of insight, which comes from the fact that his second wife, Elaine, was a regular member of St. Barnabas Church, where my brother-in-law was a curate. And so, not infrequently, Stephen would go along to church there. So he's not a kind of Dorking-like character, totally antagonistic to Christian belief. But more than that, I can't give you any particular insight. And so, therefore, to address what he believes, I've looked more at the sort of things that he's said. So I'm going to take three things that he's said and look at them. This is a rather long quote, I'm sorry about that, but it's kind of useful sometimes to see people's words in context. And it is taken from the last bit of A Brief History of Time, Hawking's book. So for those of you that can't see the back, let me read it out. "However, if we discover a complete theory, it should in time be understandable by everyone, not just by a few scientists. Then we shall all, philosophers, scientists, and just ordinary people, be able to take part in the discussion of the question of why it is that we and the universe exist. If we find the answer to that, it would be the ultimate triumph of human reason, for then we should know the mind of God." So what's he talking about? Well, what he's talking about is this challenge of unifying together what we understand are the basic forces of nature. So gravity we've already talked about. The other ones perhaps more familiar to you are magnetism and electricity. Then there's some nuclear forces, which are less familiar. And 150 years ago, Maxwell showed that electricity and magnetism were just two facets of the same thing. 40 years ago, it was shown that one of those nuclear forces was also a facet of that same electromagnetic force. And in fact, the proof that they were right in that was actually conducted by some of my colleagues at Birmingham as part of a big international team. And the kind of goal, if you like, maybe even one of the holy grails of physics, is to see all of those forces as part of the same mathematical framework. And that's what he's talking about when he talks about a complete theory. But of course, what he's saying here is that knowing that complete theory has implications, and one of the implications is that perhaps one could know the mind of God through this. So that's statement number one. Statement number two. Now, Stephen Hawking and I share another distinction, as well as our profession, in that both of us have been on the Richard and Judy show. If you want to know why I was on, you can ask me about that later. Stephen was advertising a book, and this exchange between Richard and Judy occurred. Judy said, "Do you believe there's any scientific evidence as to the existence of an afterlife?" To which Hawking replied, "Belief in an afterlife is just wishful thinking." And then Richard stepped in, "That's depressing. I was hoping for a yes there." So that's statement number two. And statement number three really takes us to some of the things that Stephen's been thinking about at the moment, which is the future of life. And this is a kind of paraphrase of some of the things that he's been saying. Essentially, he's really questioned whether intelligent life has got any long-term future. In fact, he's even suggested that he thinks it may be unlikely that mankind will see out the present millennium. And what's motivated that is, I think for him, mainly the proliferation of nuclear weapons, but also, I think, global warming to some extent. So this forms our third kind of statement of some of the things that Hawking is thinking about. Finally, I get to the point of what I was supposed to be saying. What would Jesus say to Stephen Hawking? I said to an atheist colleague of mine that I was actually going to give this talk, and he said, so I said, what would Jesus say to Stephen Hawking? He said, well, wouldn't he probably heal him? And I guess, in a sense, he probably would, right? But it's interesting that if you look in the Bible at the way Jesus interacted with people, he didn't usually just heal them out of the blue. He usually said a few things first. So let's take that as a starting point. And the other thing, of course, is extremely presumptive of me to have any opinion on what Jesus would say to Stephen Hawking. How on earth could I possibly know? So in an effort to answer the question, what I've really done is looked at some of the things that the Bible records of Jesus saying to other people and tried to apply them to those three original statements. So with that in mind, let's kind of think about some of these things. The first of which was this thing about the mind of God. Actually, that last sentence, I think Hawking has since said that he very nearly took his last sentence out of the book, but felt that if he'd done so, he would have lost 50% of the sales of the book. And that, why is that? Well, of course, this is a huge question, right? We'd all really like to know what that is. But to paraphrase his question, can I know God from physics? And in fact, you may be surprised to know that actually the Bible says, in some sense, that he's right, you can. So here's a quotation from the Bible that you can look up if you're interested. "Since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities, his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly seen by being understood from what has been made." So in a sense, we can understand something about God from the world around us. And in a sense, you'd be surprised if you couldn't. That, if God really is the author of everything that you see around us, you might expect to see some resonance in nature. It might not unambiguously point to him, but there might be some consistency. And certainly, one of the things that people have found over the years that they've puzzled about, one, Eugene Wigner is a famous theoretical physicist, and he was really struck by the way that the language of mathematics should be in any sense useful for describing the physical world. It's really a mystery as to why that works. It doesn't seem to be evolutionary advantageous for us to be able to describe the life at subatomic levels or inside a black hole. These are not regimes that life is naturally going to find itself at. Why does mathematics work at that level? Well, perhaps it is the language that God is speaking to describe nature itself. Another example might be Einstein's biggest mistake. That's what Einstein described as his biggest mistake. What was it? Well, we keep coming back to this theory of gravity that he wrote down. As scientists, we're always told to, and in fact, told it's a really good starting point to assume there's nothing special about us and the place that we are in the universe. And so the natural prediction would be that the universe as we see it now is pretty much the universe that has always been and has always existed in the same form. And that was a working assumption that many people had in the early years of the last century. When Einstein developed his theory of gravity, he realized that his equations didn't predict that. He said that his equations said that, the universe couldn't be stationary. It had to be changing with time. It had to have evolved from one thing to another. So what he did is he added an extra bit to get rid of that nastiness. And of course, what happened is experimentally, suddenly we found that the universe wasn't stationary. It was changing with time. And that was a mistake to add that extra term in. And, you know, that resonates with biblical stories that the universe did have a beginning. And the final thing, which has really struck a lot of people, but I put in brackets for reasons that I may go into, but I may not, it's a quotation from Fred Hoyle, another theoretical physicist, who said, basically, the universe is a put-up job. What did he mean by that? Well, what he meant is that if you looked at the way things worked, of course, there's certain key numbers that determine how big an atom is, you know, how long a star lives for. They're just parameters that we call them, numbers that go into the theory, and we don't have any good reason for why they should be one value or another value. But it turns out that the values that they have are extremely finely balanced, that change any one of them by sometimes even fractions of a percent, then you find that stars don't live long enough to produce carbon, and so you wouldn't get carbon-based life forms. Basically, the life as we know it is dependent on a set of a very few numbers having precisely the values that they do have. Now, put it in brackets, because people quite often call on something called the anthropic principle to explain that. You wouldn't be here to ask the question if the numbers were any different. But that's not really an explanation, and people are not particularly satisfied with that as an explanation. Part of my research, in a sense, is actually trying to see how those sort of numbers can arise naturally. So, yes, we should find something like an echo of God's existence in nature, but is it enough to tell us the mind of God? Well, in a sense, Hawking himself comes up with the answer to that one, and so here is another quote from him, which says that even if there is only one possible unified theory, it is just a set of rules and equations. What is it that breathes fire into the equations and makes a universe for them to describe? The usual approach of science, of constructing a mathematical model, cannot answer the questions of why there should be a universe for the model to describe. Why does the universe go to all the bother of existing? And in a sense, as a physicist myself, I really can see this. You know, what do I play with day by day? Equations. I run them through, I try and see how they describe nature, but they don't bring nature into existence by themselves. And Hawking also recognises that. There are questions, if you like, that science doesn't answer. How can we address this then? What would Jesus say? Well, in fact, if you look at the Bible as a whole, what is it? It's a statement about God speaking. It's kind of like this room, right? Supposing our entire existence was always spent in this room. Actually, perhaps for some of you that's the case, I don't know. imagine that you were born in a pub, you lived your life in the top floor room of a pub, and you died in a pub, and you never were allowed to go out. That's all you did. Okay, and perhaps that was true for all of us. You know, I can imagine that we might speculate as to what life was like outside the pub. There'll be those that say, you know, no, what's outside the pub is hell. You know, it's Selly Oak, or it's, you know, it's awful. Because you wouldn't have the language to describe what was outside the pub. Or you might say it's paradise, it's great. You know, it's a beautiful place outside there. Or there'll be those who say, that's a stupid question, it's a ridiculous question. You know, it has no meaning, that question. Of course, the only way you could really know what was outside is if someone came from outside and came in and told you what it was like. And in a sense, that's really what the main message of the Bible is. It's that not only is there a God, but that he speaks. That if you like, he does want us to know him with information that comes from outside. And the claim of the Bible, and indeed the claim of Jesus himself, is that if you want to know the mind of God, you must look at him. It's an absolutely shocking claim, isn't it? If you really knew me, Jesus says, then you would know my Father. That, if you like, God not only has come in from outside, but he's come in person. Look at Jesus to know the mind of God. Reinforced again, anyone who has seen me has seen the Father. So in a sense, you can know something about the mind of God, but I think Jesus would say this: if you really want to know the mind of God, look at me. One of the most shocking statements in the Bible, I'd have said. So that's perhaps one thing we can look at. And in fact, actually, scientists throughout the centuries have actually gone along with that sort of viewpoint. That people like Faraday, for example, had a very clear sense that what they did as scientists would really answer really questions of mechanism. Whereas if they wanted to know questions of purpose, why the universe bothered to exist at all, they would need outside help, intervention to get that. And they had this picture of there being two books, the book of nature that they investigated in science, and the book of God's word, God speaking into the universe that he'd created. And that if God was God, then those two views should be complementary. They would reflect the same reality. Okay, let's move on to the second of Hawking's statements of belief. This is Richard and Judy again, just to remind you. Do you believe there's any existence of an afterlife, says Judy. Hawking, belief in an afterlife is just wishful thinking. Actually, what I quite liked is Paul Merton's take on this. So this clip, I think, was shown on Have I Got News For You, the news quiz program. And Paul Merton said, what would he know? And isn't that exactly the problem? I mean, that why is Hawking any more qualified to answer this question than you or I or anybody else? So what do you want if you want to find out if there's an afterlife? Well, you want someone who can speak with authority. And so Jesus made a kind of shocking statement here again. So one of his friends died, and this is what he said. I am the resurrection and the life. And then proceeded to bring him back from the dead. But you see, again, it's still a little bit like, you know, the person having to come from outside. What would it really take to understand whether there was an afterlife or not? You'd want somebody to be able to say, well, I was dead once. And that kind of doesn't usually happen. But of course, that is, again, the central claim of authentication of Jesus' life. I was dead once. And the Bible knows that that's its central claim, and it even says it is. It says that if, you know, in another part of the Bible, it says, if Christ had not been raised from the dead, that is, your faith, the Christian faith, is futile. It's a waste of time. Jesus isn't raised from the dead. You might as well tear the Bible up and throw it away. It's just somebody else's opinion. Hawking's opinion is just as good. But if someone can say, I was dead once, then, and that's the band from outside, then maybe that's worth listening to. The final question that Hawking left us with was, is mankind doomed? So we've seen, if Jesus is the man from outside, the man who once was dead, maybe if he's authenticated himself that way, it might be at least worth looking at what he came to tell us. And here are some of the things which kind of resonate maybe a little bit with what Hawking said. So these are some of the words of Jesus. Whoever hears my words and believes in him who sent me has eternal life and will not be condemned. He's crossed from death to life. So there is a hint there that there is a problem, right? Condemnation does have a sort of sense of the doom of mankind. Seems to be speaking beyond the doom that perhaps Hawking envisaged. But the good thing is that there's obviously a solution to this problem. And if you like, that's another part of the main message of the Bible, that mankind maybe is doomed. But there is a solution to that problem. It's kind of like, I guess, that Jesus himself is like the lighthouse, pointing out danger, but maybe a bit more than that, pointing out a solution to that danger. I'm not going to go into the details of that. I've just, if you like, tried to answer the question. What are the claims, what sort of things would Jesus say to Stephen Hawking or someone with the same sort of questions? But you know, maybe you're asked, you know, maybe the question that motivated you to come tonight is the puzzle of what Christianity could have to do with theoretical physics and the sort of thing that Stephen Hawking works on. And, you know, perhaps surprising, it may be surprising to you, but I see a lot of sympathy, if you like, with the work of a theoretical physicist and the work of the Bible. See, for one thing, what we know in physics is that the truth matters. There is a right or wrong answer when we do something in physics. You know, you might be tempted to sort of think that the place on the university campus that you should go to look for the least believing part of the university faculty would be in the physics department. But in fact, you'd be wrong. In fact, probably the place you would want to go to would be the philosophy department. I guess if you can't really decide whether you exist, you might have difficulty deciding whether God does. For a physicist, truth matters, you see. You know, our careers fall on the basis of whether we're predicting things that are right. Now, it may be that you think that some of the things that I've said are just a list of impossible stuff. Maybe you think that Christian faith is like believing six impossible things before breakfast, like the Queen of Hearts. But you know, the other sort of resonance I find in my faith and what I do for a living is the importance of testable things. You see, ultimately, Christian faith is an experimental subject. You know, my subject is theory. I write equations, but Nobody listens to what I say unless what I write down has some consequences, things that you could go away and test. Ultimately, experiment is what counts. And the claims of Jesus actually go along similar lines, right? There were people in the Bible who needed experimental proof. Thomas, this quote there, "I sit and unless I see the nail marks, I won't believe." The Bible does talk about proof, and it's an experimental one, and that's really the challenge facing all of us. You know, what are you going to do with those claims? You can decide they're wrong, you can decide they're deceptive, or you can decide that they're right. You know, those claims of Jesus do have truth. You know, either you decide they're true or you decide they're false. So that pretty much concludes what I had to say. Let me conclude in the words of Stephen Hawking.
I think that concludes our business. Good night.
Okay, that's it.
Thank you very much indeed, Andy. That's much food for thought. We're going to take just a 2-minute break to use refuel at the bar. We'll do what you want to do. Someone's going to go around and collect up bits of paper. If you've written a question or a comment, if you could hold that up so that they can come round and grab it, and then we'll start up again in 2 minutes. Thank you.